Welcome back to Catalysts in Conversation, presented by the National Association of School Psychologists. I'm NASP President Peter Faustino. In the first few episodes of this podcast, we've been able to explore issues that directly impact the work of school psychologists, from policy battles surrounding social-emotional learning to the impact of social media use on young people and how schools can support them. Today, I'm excited to discuss another topic that is incredibly important for school psychologists in our efforts to serve youth, families, and schools. That is mental health advocacy. As we all know, our nation has been experiencing a mental health crisis, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic. And young people have been deeply impacted over the past 4 years. As I interact with youth around the country, they will often say that they are not doing okay. And honestly, adults are struggling too. They feel for a variety of reasons that they are in a state of fight or flight, craving better ways to manage their mental health. And while it's difficult to point to a single cause, I am hopeful that conversations like the one today will lead to actionable steps and change. Today, I'm excited to explore this topic with Karis Jan Myrick, the Vice President of Partnerships and Innovation at Inseparable. Inseparable is a growing coalition of people from across the country who share a common goal to fundamentally improve mental health care policy, to take care of ourselves, our loved ones, and our communities. So Karis, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is so exciting.
Yeah, I feel it too. So thank you. I would love to start just by learning more about you, your story, and what brought you to this work.
Yeah, so thanks for asking. And when I think about this question, it's almost like asking me, I don't know, it's like asking me a big question that sometimes I don't even know how to answer, right? It's like, how do you solve world peace? Or tell me why you're interested in this job.
You know, all of like, the reasons, right?
Yeah. It's one of those big questions. So I wish it were something like big and sort of pivotal or catalytic, as you say. But I think honestly, it has to do with sort of seeing people who are hurting. And then continuing to see it year after year, decade after decade. And I am a very action-oriented, problem-solving type of person. And I also love to solve complex problems. That's the way my brain works, is I never see anything as like simple. I always see things as complex and interconnected. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I was thinking about, well, how can we impact change? I would be knocking at the wrong door or pushing the wrong lever. And I found that sometimes the secret sauce is in policy. And I was like, policy? What's policy? I don't know what policy is. And I would ask people to help me and mentor me. And I could see that change could happen when a policy was changed, because there may be something that may be the barrier to, for example, a school psychologist being able to do their work, or a person being able to get the services they want when, where, and how they want them. That there's some weird policy set in some weird place, right? It has nothing to do with how people work. And I was like, you know what? I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of that change. I want to learn more about it. And I also want to be a part of making those changes, particularly in mental health.
Oh, I love that. I'm a bit of a policy geek myself, but I was not always that way. I used to swear that I would never get involved in politics or policy. And then I realized that there are people making decisions that affect my life, and I probably should speak up and get involved. Yeah. So, yeah.
I said I would never work for the government ever. I'm like, the government? Why would I work for the government? That's so restrictive, as I get a job with the federal government. I found out actually the federal government has the ability to do some pretty creative stuff. Yeah. There are always boundaries. You just have to know where the boundary is. Are you in the square, the rectangle, the rhombus? Where are you? Where is that boundary, right?
Oh, I love it. I feel like school psychologists are really on the front lines of youth mental health and the crisis. I mean, I've said that for a very long time, right? I mean, we see every day how it's impacting children and their families. From your experience, what's some of the more important things that school psychologists have to keep in mind around supporting students' mental health?
Great question. And I always start with the student themselves. And you know, I actually used to work in schools long time ago in another career and another life. And one of the things that I learned is sometimes students who look like they're doing well aren't doing well at all, right? And I've learned this too from students from different cultures is sometimes silence is what's expected. And in that silence, they're really struggling. But who gets paid attention to are the kids who are, quote unquote, acting out. I don't like to use that term, but you know, are more visibly having issues that maybe disrupt the classroom or disrupt other students, things like that, while the quiet student is just sitting there screaming inside, "Help me, help me, help me." So I've heard from quiet students is, "Can you please pay attention to the quiet student?" Also, I think that understanding as school psychologists, of course, you know, work with students and families. What is the context in which they exist? What is the cultural context? What is the community context? And how often are students and or their families having what I think MLK would say a creative maladjustment response to things that are happening around them, that even if we give them the best emotional support, the thing that they're struggling with may be racism, maybe discrimination, maybe any of those other social justice issues. So, and then there's another thing I was thinking about is I never even heard of a school psychologist until I went to a school for psychology. So my educational background is in industrial organizational psychology, and I went to the California School of Professional Psychology, now called Alliant International University, and they have a program for school psychologists. I'm like, well, who are you guys? I'd never heard of you guys before, right? So I think if I've never heard of a school psychologist, who else hasn't heard of a school psychologist? So you know, I would think that making sure that it's not just assumed that parents or community members even know that the school psychologists exist. And then lastly is, hey, what are those policy levers? Like, why can't it might be a school psychologist, I really want to do this thing, but there's some regulation or policy or piece of legislation that's getting in the way of the psychologist being able to do the work that they got into the business of doing, and knowing that they can be a part of changing that. They don't have to sit back and kind of go, oh, well, I guess that's just the way it is.
So often in NASP, we are talking to members and the field about the different sort of like ways that someone can advocate. I mean, we talk about advocacy and it feels like it's only got to be at this national level, but sometimes just speaking on behalf of a student or finding a way to amplify somebody's voice, or even more so, what I heard you saying is like centering students' voices. Those are all forms of advocacy in different ways. And I think it's, you know, we can never say it enough how critically important that is and inherent to what school psychologists do, even though we're like the stealth profession, like we still gotta sort of get our names out there a little bit more.
I think I love that. You know, I also have done peer work in mental health, and one of the core competencies in the training for peers is around advocacy. And when we say advocacy, we're talking about it at different levels, which is self-advocacy, helping the person you're supporting be able to advocate for themselves, advocate for systems change, either as the peer or helping the person see, well, you know, that's a systems issue. Here's where you can take action to also change the system. And then also community-based advocacy. How can you partner in with the community to think about advocacy that may need to be done?
And I guess you just started down that road, right? I know a lot about Inseparable, but your organization is focused on empowering Americans to demand policy that will better care for the mental health of our communities. Can you tell us more about what does that look like at both the local and national level? Like, how can school psychologists help Inseparable or advocates and allies sort of like fight for policies that we need in our country?
Sure. So I'll start with a little bit about who Inseparable is and what we do broadly, and then I'll get laser focused. So Inseparable is a policy shop, for the lack of better way of putting it. That's the easiest way I know how to say what it is. And basically, we focus in four areas. One is youth mental health, which is, can also include school-based mental health. The other is creating a better response, or crisis systems response, and creating better crisis systems. And then also access, which is access to care and closing the treatment gap. And then the last is workforce, and increasing the workforce, behavioral health workforce. So because we're talking about school psychologists, we'll like hone in on what this looks like for youth in school mental health. So we have a campaign. So we run campaigns too, which is a little bit different. Many organizations are C3s, or nonprofits with a C3 designation, which means they have sort of this line they can't cross when it comes to doing maybe lobbying or other types of legislative policy work. So we're both a C3 and a C4. So that helps us be able to go beyond the C3 line and go into the C4 space. We have a lot more freedom to do partisan stuff alongside bipartisan stuff, things like that. So, because we have this unique ability, what we do is we bring a lot of organizations that are C3s together in a partnership in it to do a campaign. And this campaign for schools, school mental health and youth mental health, is called the Hopeful Futures Campaign. Because what? Youth are our hopeful future. Okay, that was not good. But anyway,
I love it. We can
so
start breaking out in song. I believe the children are our future,
okay,
right?
you can sing, I will not, but thank you. I do not have a good singing voice. So, but that's exactly it. That's exactly it. So it's a Hopeful Futures campaign. And we bring together, right now we have about 30 partners across the country that are either local or national organizations, and in many spaces that include mental health. It includes NASP is a partner, for example, National PTA, UNICEF USA, some of the quote unquote, I'm just going to use this term, usual suspects, like NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness, MHA, Active Minds Jet, et cetera. So we've got 30 of these organizations who work with us across the country. And then primarily we do state by state work. So sometimes that's where the secret sauce is. Sometimes you don't want to bite off the whole apple. You just need to take a piece to get at the whole apple. And that piece would be state by state, and then eventually maybe some federal work, of course. So to be very specific, what does this look like? This sounds all well and good, and I'm talking the geeky talk of policy. Yay, yay. And I'm not really I'm policy, but I'm really partnerships. I just love people and pulling people together to solve complex problems. We can't do it by ourselves. And so what we do is we'll engage, for example, in some work in a state. And we'll use a report that we have called the School Mental Health Report Card. I almost forgot what it was called. School Mental Health Report Card. Who likes getting a report card? Everybody raise your hand, and nobody's hand goes up, right? So we did not give A, B, C's, or D's. We just gave people colored in pencils. You got four colored in pencils. You're doing a good job. You get three, you could improve. You get two, oh my. You get one, oh goodness. You don't get any colored in pencils. Look to your neighbor and see how you can improve. So in this report, it helps legislators, local folks, just your general public, be able to see how a state is doing in policy areas that would really make a difference for kids and youth mental health in schools. And using that report, we can also see where a state might need a little bit of help. And Inseparable is like, hello, we're here to help with our gazillion partners here. And our partners then access folks who are in the grassroots of that particular state, for example. And if we're doing some policy change and need some help getting a piece of legislation passed, it's the people whose stories will really matter. It's not Inseparable. It's not the lobbyists. It's the people. It's the families, the students, the school psychologists, the people who are on the ground who are impacted by the piece of legislation that will improve the life of our young people. So, for example, we've been able to pass legislation that does things like increase funding for the ratio of school counselors to students in, I believe it's in Georgia. I probably won't be able to say all the places, but we've also been able to, for example, remove barriers of needing a diagnosis in order for kids to receive mental health services and get that reimbursed by Medicaid. So before, you would need to have a diagnosis. Well, that's now been removed in some states. We've also been able to increase funding for rural mental telehealth in a particular state where that was really, really needed for kids in schools. So it's that kind of thing that starts to chip away at the bigger piece of the apple by doing incremental change state by state. Does that help kind of explain what we do and how we do it?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I mean, you took a fairly large, complex sort of like network, and I think made it very understandable. So thank you. And you know, what I was really sort of reflecting on was this idea that school psychologists are working every day with individuals with various mental health challenges. And I'm hoping that when they listen to this podcast, they'll understand that they're not alone, that there are 30 plus different organizations, including Inseparable, sort of like bringing this team together to say, we got your back. You know, we want to hear those stories. We want to, empower you to do that individual work, but we're looking to remove some of those barriers that get in the way. And that's just so critically
Exactly.
important.
And you said something about we want to hear the stories. We've just started a story bank as well. And
Oh.
so, if there are folks who are listening to the podcast who have a particular story about, and I will say, I talk about the yippee and the icky, right? So, the struggles and the triumphs. So you can have both. But so if you want to share a story about this didn't go well, and I really want to see change happening either in my state or at the national level, you can actually put your story into that story bank that can be used, with Inseparable, with your permission. Of course, you're doing it with your permission and consent. And we might send that story out or post it elsewhere for legislators, policymakers, regulators to hear.
That's so important. I know in that policy work, it's the stories that are often the ones that get a legislator's attention or people can share to help understand why change is so important. This the work you're doing is so important. I mean, school psychologists, I know they want to be the trusted adults in the lives of children. I mean, it's a word we use a lot around trust. But in all your years of doing this work, I mean, is there advice that you can offer listeners on how to do it better, right? I mean, how to connect and make sure that the yip, what is it, the yip and the
The yippee to the icky, or the icky to the yippee, whichever way we got to go, right?
Sort of reflects back on youth and sort of like helps make change possible.
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, trust is such a thing, right? So I guess I can tell a personal story here. It didn't happen when I was a youth. It happened when I was an adult, but fair enough to say it was a lot about trust. And I was having a hard time. I have my own lived experience of having a mental health diagnosis, and the conversations I was having with the therapist were very like surface level. How are you doing? Fine. What'd you have for dinner? Chicken. It was like nothing really deep. And I'm sitting there like in this like turmoil inside, and we're having this really light conversation. And finally, I switched therapist, and the therapist stopped the conversation, which really wasn't a conversation. It was just weird what it was. I mean, it was a weird, it was me not being able to go deep because I really didn't know how to. And he said, he leaned over and he said, "You don't trust me, do you?" And I was like, "No, actually, I don't." And it was the first person who ever asked me directly, "Do I trust them?" And that was the issue. I didn't trust anybody. I didn't trust people to tell them my deepest, darkest. And I could have been sitting on that couch for years, and literally it was a couch. I know that seems very, but
Cliche.
it really was a couch. But I could have been sitting there for years kind of talking about like the weather of the day, or I didn't like somebody or something, which is important but not really important. So I think being even able to ask somebody like, "Are you trusting me, and what can I do to help build that trust?" Or what he did, which I really appreciate, is said, "It will take us time to build trust. And I'm hoping as we continue to get to know each other," and there's this bidirectional thing that sometimes doesn't happen between a therapist and the person they're working with. And maybe that was also was like, he's a blank slate and I got to tell you everything. That does not feel equitable, right? So I think there was a little bit more of me being able to say what I needed in order for there to be trust. Number one, not to sit on the couch. So one time we switched chairs and I sat in his chair and he sat on the couch. I wanted to talk through playing games. And so we, and I know kids do this already, but I didn't know the power of being able to use a game for even the therapist to share more while we were playing the game as I was sharing more. So I think there's something about being able to create what looks more like a real relationship, even within the confines of the ethics of the of your profession. I think that's important. I also think helping families and parents understand what is this thing psychology? What is a psychologist? Like, are you going to go digging around in my kid's brain and kind of do something to my kid? Or, how do I explain this to the neighbors? Like, we don't hang out our dirty laundry, kind of thing. And again, having a mental health condition is not dirty, by the way,
No.
but that's kind of the language that might be used in certain cultures. So that families also have to have their own trust of this whole process. And being able to explain to them and or community members, like maybe to a church community, what is a school psychologist? What do we do? How do we do it? How do we support the family? How do we support the student? What is our role? So that there becomes trust of the profession broadly. So I think there are a couple of things like that that have nothing to do with policy, but maybe just have to do with, of course, meeting people where they are and then helping people understand exactly, because it's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, right? Sadly, like psychology and psychiatry is behind the green curtain. And you don't get to see behind the green curtain. And so being able to kind of see behind the green curtain can also, that transparency, I think, can also help build trust.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. I think we are having more open conversations than I have ever experienced in my career. But there is still a stigma that is alive and well in too many places. And I really appreciate your advice, both as a psychologist and this as your full-time work and the lived experience of that. Because I think if I hear one more time when I talk to somebody about what I do and they're like, "Are you analyzing me right now?" And it's like, no, that is not exactly how this works. Those reminders you gave, I think, are so important for school psychologists. Too often they're, I think, overthinking, how to engage in this. And sometimes we might just have to ask those questions, have those like sort of push through the discomfort a little bit, I'm hearing you say, right? I mean, yeah, please.
And I'm also wondering too, how do psychologists and those in the licensed professions, how and when do they find the ability to tell a piece of their personal story that is appropriate to tell, the appropriate time and the appropriate piece? Again, thinking back to the same therapist, when I said, "Well, you have no idea. You clearly don't understand. You'll never understand. You are not living this experience." And I think I was yelling, which is very rare because I don't yell. I didn't display anger because that was one of my problems. I don't display anger. I do now, but anyway, see what therapy can do. It can help you display your anger. But anyway, he said, "Well, let me tell you about my personal lived experience and kind of this is what happened to me and this is and I did have to take medication for my mental health condition and I had to kind of understand what does this mean and what is all of this mean in the context of my life." And I was like, "Wait, what? I've been seeing you for 2 years, and this is the first time I hear you have lived experience." I was a little upset, right? I was like, "Why am I hearing this for the first time?" But I was hearing it for the first time because the time had to be right, and there had to be bi-directional trust for the person to be able to open up and just tell me a snippet. I didn't need to know anymore. I really didn't need to know anymore. That was enough for me to know, okay, this isn't foreign to that person. It's not textbook. It's real life plus textbook. And that was super helpful.
And that might have been the best advice you just gave, right? Is that idea of like, as psychologists and school psychologists are thinking through the kids that they're working with right now in the moment, or listening on the car ride to work, or at their desk writing a report, and they're thinking of a kid. And you don't want to open up, fully Can you share a little bit, right, with that student, just enough so that they understand? And it's not about you, it's really about the student, but just sort of giving
Right.
space for wherever that conversation will go afterwards, but not to be afraid to be human.
And if there isn't an experience, I agree. And if there isn't an experience, you don't have a personal experience, or it
Right.
is your personal experience to share or not share, right? So,
Yeah.
am I
Yeah.
saying everybody should be that kind of open book? No. But it may be, you know what? I know somebody who is talking about some things very similar to you. Do you mind if I introduce them to you? Or there's a youth peer supporter, and you guys know the word peer. It's like somebody who's going through the same things you're going through, who's around the same age. It could be a near peer, somebody who's near your age. Would you like to talk to that person? Because sometimes kids feel so alone, like, oh my God, I am the only one going through this,
Yeah.
and are afraid to continue to share. So, how can school psychologists also partner with young youth peer support, whether they're certified peer specialist or youth
Yeah.
groups, where the person can know they're not alone, or they're great. I was just reading this great book by a young man named Tony Weaver called Weirdo, just came out, and it's a comic book, like a gra it's a
Oh.
pretty it's a tome, but it's a comic book, and it's great. And he talks about what it was like for him when he was in junior high school, I think, going into high school, and how he thought he was a weirdo until he found his tribe of other
Yeah.
people who were interested in things that he was interested in, who gave him voice, and also when he disclosed to his cousin that he was struggling, cousin told their parents, who told his parents, who everybody sat down and decided, would you like to speak to a psychologist? And that's what happened. So, yeah, sometimes it may be a conduit to you is going to be other people, or building that trust is also going to be, the psychologist being seen as a reputable resource to connect the young person to somebody else.
I really appreciate that advice as well, Karis. Thank you. Because I think we are, as a profession, still working harder at looking like the students that we are working with, right? Being the students that we are working with and finding representation in school psychology. And so I've often leaned into just staying curious with students if I don't have a shared experience to offer them. And I think one of the best compliments I ever got was when a principal asked a student about me and said, tell me about Dr. Pete. And it was, he really wants to know more about me. Like he seems to really care about my experience. And that for me was, what kept me going, at least for that year or probably beyond.
Yeah,
So.
awesome,
Yeah,
awesome.
yeah. And I love what you're saying about that sense of belonging, right? I mean, I feel like I started my career with a sense recognizing how important that was, and then you go on and you get all these advanced degrees and experience and read research and science, and it all comes back to a sense of belonging after you do some of that. So,
Yeah.
such terrific work. This work can be hard. I mean, we are sort of both acknowledging a variety of situations where burnout is something that we potentially struggle with. And I know in our profession, this is one of the things that we're spending a lot of time talking about this year. What are ways you find joy in those moments of difficulty? I mean, what do you do to combat burnout in your own work?
Oh, okay. So, there's so many things because it can happen so easily and so quickly. So a couple of things. I'm a Fred Rogers fan. I'm old enough to be a Fred Rogers fan. And I'll never forget when Fred Rogers said things like, look to the helpers. And so that's one thing, is looking to other people. And okay, so it's not even a person I look to. I look to Elmo. It's so, I'm just a giant child also. Well, hello, I'm wearing a Hello Kitty shirt. So I'm a giant child, who is, and I'm an outer giant child. I don't have an inner child. My inner child is always out. But I love Elmo. I will turn on my Tickle Me Elmo. I have the original one that still works. And sometimes I just need to get that right endorphin or whatever it is going by just laughing. And no matter what mood I'm in or what's happening, turn on Tickle Me Elmo, and I'm good to go. I'm just good to go.
Elmo, if you're listening, we're saying thank you.
Right. And I also do kind of other things. I really get excited when I see change happen. Right. And so sometimes change takes a while to happen. Well, it does take a while to happen often. So I try to find a positive story. I try to read a positive story. So we can get on, we can doom scroll social media. I don't want to doom scroll social media. I want to do the yippie scroll, right? And I want to scroll and I want to find exciting stories, or I want to find somebody saying something positive. Or that's how I found the book, by the way, by Tony Weaver. I was like, weirdo, what's that about? Right? Like, that's up my alley. I'm a little weird. Right. And it was just such a good story. It was a hard story because there were some hard truths in there, but it was told so beautifully and told about community and family and, supporting each other. It was just that kind of stuff is a good self-care. Also, embracing the power of no. No, I cannot do that. No, thanks for asking. No, not today. because I'm usually a yes person. I'm a pleaser. I try to please people. I feel like I let people down if I don't. But I found out how to say no. And that is just like I know how to do yes and, I know how to do no and. No, I'm not able to. Let me connect you to somebody who can. Can we schedule this for another time? Oh, you need it right away. Okay, is it all right if I connect you to somebody else? Or here's a resource you could use. So it doesn't have to be about me doing it. It can be about me getting the person to something so that they can get it done. It just won't be me. So I have really embraced the power of no, and also understanding where my boundaries are, whether they be value-based boundaries or just real boundaries. And I stick with them and I help people understand, well, this is sort of where my boundary is. But that's a hard pass for me. No, can't do that. Right. Yeah, and then also where I work, wherever that is, trying to create a mental health friendly workplace, because we spend a lot of time at work. So it should be a place where also we can mind our own mental health so that we can be present to be mentally prepared and be fully present to help other people, especially in the helping profession. And so I've done that when I ran a peer run organization. I created a this like wellness room. It was the staff who said this is what they wanted in the room. They wanted a couch, they wanted music, they wanted candles. We couldn't do the candles because that would have been no. they did want sometimes if they wanted to take their laptops in there and work in kind of a zen-y environment, that they could work in a zen type of environment versus their office. We got rid of the fluorescent lights, and that is kind of what we created. And they sort of created the space. We changed the color of the wall, the paint of the wall. And I was able to also do this at the federal government, which, you know, who would know that you could do that? We could not buy anything, right? Because so we had to work with what we had. But it was something that work hard. You know, we work hard. We should play hard and take care of ourselves as hard as we work, right?
Now I can't wait to meet you in person, because my motto is work hard, play harder is.
You don't want to see my office. When I have an office, I'm a remote worker, but my office here looks the same. If I look to the right, I've got my advocacy Barbie. I've got a whole bunch of puppets. I've got these Rock'em Sock'em robots. I mean, I have every, you know, I have my Zen coins that give me affirmations. It's a mess. It's a mess, but it's a good mess.
Yeah. This is great stuff. I mean, you have to take care of yourself in order to take care of others. That is what I'm hearing you say loud and clear. And I was actually, it's so funny you say about the power of no. I was in Michigan just this past week, and I was talking with their leaders of their school psych association. And one of the leaders had a phrase where she said, "Love says no." And I was like, "What? I don't understand that." And she said, "Yeah, because I love you, I'm going to say no. Love says no." And it comes from a place of love, but it's actually healthy to use that word more often than not. And I'm still struggling with it, but I think you motivated me. I think you motivated me.
Yeah. And I want to say one other thing about no, that now that we're here on the no word. and again, this comes from, being in therapy, et cetera, and, you know, receiving services. Taking the time to understand when someone says no. Is it a no to you? Is it a no to the treatment? Or is the no something else? And I find a lot of times the no on the side of the treatment team, I'll just put it that way, is about the person in receiving services getting to somebody else's yes, rather than us sitting with the person's no and really deeply understanding what does that no mean to that person? What are they really saying no to? And what is it that they want to say yes to? And I think that's so important for kids because sometimes they don't even like, what? Like, I'm not doing that. What are you talking about? Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So
that's often their first response, actually. And as adults, we have to sort of think through and say, what are they trying to communicate? Right. They use that word.
Yeah. I really struggled with, again, I didn't know what a school psychologist was. And I had an unfortunate experience when I was in kindergarten that sort of changed how I understood time. I didn't understand time at all. And I was perpetually late, but I would get bullied for being late when I was in kindergarten by the teacher, sadly. So anytime I'm late, you know, whether it be going to school, going to work, going to an appointment, I have like super high anxiety. But in the past, it would be so high, I couldn't even walk into the room. And one of the teachers actually recognized that I was struggling with something. And I would sit outside the classroom. And this is when I was a child. I would sit outside the classroom and cry. And she couldn't understand like what was going on. And she, oh, come on in. It's okay. And I just couldn't. I was just like almost frozen. And she would sit down on the floor with me and just kind of help me get in inch by inch by inch and just sit with me and be with me the whole time. So I think she understood when I was saying no, I really literally couldn't do it. And so just being able to work with me at my no in order to get to what I really did want to do, I did want to go into the classroom. I just couldn't. And we were never able to unpack at that time what was going on. We didn't unpack it until I was well into my 30s. But I think that's another thing when we were talking about trust and no and all those kind of things that just sitting with someone and just being in their discomfort, because sometimes it's uncomfortable to say no because you really want to say yes to something. Yeah.
I really appreciate that story. They're such, again, reminders about the work that we do and the way we approach youth around this topic. I don't think we can ever hear it enough. So, Karis, thank you. You're no stranger to podcasts. I'm very new at this, but you host a podcast of your own titled Unapologetically Black Unicorns. Can you share a little bit about that? What topics do you explore in your conversations? And how do people access the show? Who do you engage with there? Sure.
So similar to you, I'm a person who, though I am naturally very, very shy, oddly, everybody says, no, you're not. Yes, I am. I'm naturally shy, but one-on-one, I can have intense and incredible conversations with people. And I keep thinking to myself, why do I get to hold the conversation? This is like, I wish people could listen into the conversation. These are cool conversations. And also, again, as a person with lived experience of a mental health condition, when I was looking for somebody who looked like me, so I will tell you, none of my therapists have looked like me. None of my psychiatrists have looked like me. I am African American, and I'm also a member of the Muscogee Nation. And I have not, in general, been able to access folks who look like me who are licensed providers. So I would always ask, do you know anybody who looks like me who can talk about what I'm going through? Because I don't know if what I'm going through is related to discrimination, if it's related to my gender, I have no idea. And I don't always want us therapizing away or medicating away things that are, I have to still deal with every day that possibly we could change, like those structural things, right? So it was really hard. And then finally, one day I was introduced to somebody who looked like me, Miss Jackie McKinney, who's since passed away a couple years ago. But that was a pivotal moment to be able to talk to somebody who has been through what I have been through and to see what she was doing. This is before I was still on disability at this time, where I could see the possibility. It's like, oh, like my parents told me, you know, no matter your diagnosis, you can do whatever you want. No matter your skin color, you can do whatever you want. We will support you. Okay, that's what parents are supposed to tell you. So yes, I believed it. But at the same time, it was like I needed more to know that that was really possible. And I needed to see people who look like me. And just having that one conversation was enough to spur me on into also doing some of this work that I do. And I continued to meet people, and I was doing this testimony for Representative John Lewis at the time. And somebody heard me give this testimony. It was about telehealth for rural communities and communities of color. And I'm giving this testimony and I'm giving doing all my thing. And I get this email from somebody who says, I had no idea you were Black. And I'm like, okay, that's a nice way to introduce yourself to me. Okay. And then finally it was like, I'm Black too. And I'm like, okay, now this is making sense a little bit, right? She basically told me she had never talked to anybody or seen anybody openly talk about their lived experience of mental health as a Black person. And she said, do you know other people? And it was like somehow we're in a secret club. I know lots of people. So I started introducing her to people. And then the people were like, well, who are you introducing her to? And I would say, and then they would tell me, oh, wait a minute, I don't know that person. I'm like, oh. So I just was doing all this introduction. I said, I actually don't have time for this. I mean, I do.
Yeah.
So what I decided is to capture their stories, and I was going to put them on Google Drive. And my friend said, well, you've heard this thing. It is called a podcast. And I'm like, what? She said, yeah, it's called a podcast. So that's really what my podcast started as, is an ability or a place to capture stories, particularly for people of color with lived or living experience of a mental health or substance use condition who are pretty much not known to each other or to the broader mental health community, to have conversations about what they're doing, their recovery story, and the like. It's expanded to include providers who are also very underrepresented, from psychologists, psychiatrists, occupational therapists, et cetera, and also to talk about all sorts of subjects that impact our mental health and well-being. We have young people, we have series that they have a whole series of young people talking about mental health and mental health policy. We have movement leaders who have been other movements who talk about what does it mean to be a movement, because we're supposed to be a mental health movement. We can borrow from other movements. And then we also have, I say part of the podcast is just to talk about anything cool that expands human existence. So we do that too.
Another small sort of like, question.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, like solving world peace. Right. So, it's great. I've loved it. I've met people. I said, I try to find positive stories sometimes on social media or through Amazon. I've met authors who are writing incredible work who I would have never known if I didn't reach out and say, hey, can I talk to you about this book? And then ask them if they'd like to be on the podcast if it's something that would be interesting. And the podcast now is in its third year. It started off as a birthday present to myself, to the world, if you will. That sounds really weird, but it's self-funded. It's not through my work. I don't take any type of, I don't do sponsorships or anything like that. And it can be found on pretty much all podcast platforms.
Yeah. It's incredible. Representation matters. It's so important. I mean, it's all the reasons that we are working in this space. Unfortunately, schools, I think, still value monolingual, white, able-bodied strengths. And there's, we need more conversations, more individuals sort of getting involved in this. And it's amazing that you've been a conduit to bring all these people together, all these conversations together. And I know my presidential theme is this idea of being a catalyst. It's sort of like bringing energy together so that, change can occur. And you are epitomizing that. So thank you.
Thank
sharing
you.
All
Thank
of that.
You so much. I'm so happy to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Love talking to people. So this is great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Feel the same way. Thank you, Karis. Thank you again to Karis Myrick for this incredible conversation. I hope that school psychologists listening to this conversation will come away with a sense of empowerment and an understanding of the ways that they can support young people amidst our nationwide mental health crisis. That way, we can take this conversation and put it into action. We'll be back with another episode of Catalysts and Conversations soon. Until then, I'm Peter Faustino. Thanks for listening.